CoinWorld Plus is your new way to collect, manage your inventory, digitally authenticate coins, create your want list, buy and sell coins, and much more. Learn more about CoinWorld Plus at coinworldplus.com or download the app now at Google Play or the App Store.
Welcome to the CoinWorld Podcast with your host, Jeff Stark.
And as I've said from day one of this show, this is a big tent hobby. There's a lot of room for folks.
And Larry Jewett.
And learning has been such a tremendous amount of this journey.
The CoinWorld Podcast.
Welcome back to another episode of the CoinWorld Podcast. I'm Jeff Stark.
And I'm Larry Jewett. So glad to have everybody along here once again as we've got another great episode in store for today, and hopefully you'll enjoy it as much as I did when I was part of the interview. And certainly do appreciate you, Jeff, being the one to round up our guest here. And it took a lot of work, but we finally got him corralled to the point where we could get it. So it's certainly the effort is well worth it when you realize what we're going to get out of this one. So thanks for doing all that and getting Cameron on the podcast here. And I understand it was his first podcast, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, we had Cameron McLean, a gentleman in Scotland at the Hunterian Museum, postdoc fellow or a student at University of Glasgow. And I would not have come up with the name had it not been for my friend Dan Marion at the Missouri Numismatic Society. So for all the work that went into it, we can thank Dan for pointing us that way. It's very interesting to explore Scottish numismatics in an academic sense and an academic approach. And so we do that in just a little bit here with Cameron. Fun time, learned a lot. And I think anyone listening to the interview will walk away with that good feeling that we had.
Yeah, and I think it's just one of those elements of this broad spectrum of numismatics that sometimes we don't give a lot of attention to. It's more about collecting, more about, you know, acquiring. It's more about going to shows. It's more about things like that. But there are places where you're going to find some of the historic aspects of it that we're going to talk about a little bit more. But even in this country, there are places where you can go. I picked up a brochure about a small place in Iowa, picked up a brochure when I was at the Central State Show. And there are just all kinds of different places where you can find and learn about historic sides of things, whether it be, the world and ancient coins, whether it be paper money and, the national banknotes, lots of different places where you can see museums have some displays sometimes. And you just never know where you're going to find. I mean, obviously, one of the places I went to over the weekend, I was looking for something else. But it was a flea market, well-known flea market, and one of the individuals had some knickknacks, but they also had a couple of cases full of coins. And in one of the cases, I saw a graded, it was an AG3, granted, but it was still a graded 1916D dime, winged Liberty or Mercury dime. And it's like, dude, I mean, I you don't see those every day. And even at that low grade like that, it was still probably a little more than I was going to chunk down that day. But just the idea that you can find this stuff out there. And, it's great to have the opportunity to see it, whether it be at a flea market or perhaps if you see it in a museum someplace. And it's really neat to know that it's out there because it's so important to not just this country, but all the way around the world, too. So that's why I give Cameron's interview a listen here a little bit later on here. History being so very important to us now, let's just go ahead and throw it back in time as we get ready to look at this week in numismatic history.
Sure. We hop in the magical mystery machine and go back to June 8th, 1942. What happened then? Well, that was when the Bureau of Engraving and Printing received the official order to print notes for use on the Hawaiian Islands. These are the Series 1934 $5 Hawaii Emergency Federal Reserve Notes. The order came on June 8th, but they actually began printing them 2 days before on June 6th. They kind of just started early to save time. So we've kind of got a twofer there, if you want to look at it that way. June 6th and June 8th, 1942. Hawaii is, of course, of interest to me right now, because I am working on the story for the next monthly. And we talk about these notes in the in a little exploration of Hawaiian-related numismatics. And the Hawaii overprint notes, there's all sorts of denominations. I know 1, 5, 10, probably others, I'm forgetting, 20s. I don't remember about 50s or 100s, but in any event, the overprint was there so that the notes could be suspended. Their legal tender status could be suspended in case of occupation by enemy combatants. So wartime numismatics throughout history, whether that's in an ancient context and the mints that were traveling with Roman generals, whether that was various medals marking treaties after the events, or celebrating folks like somebody like Lord Admiral Nelson, who died in battle. There's no shortage of ways that the hobby has intersected and been affected by military conflicts. And so that was, I thought, interesting in a U.S. sense. That was this week in numismatic history. Now,
well, also, while you're talking about that, I mean, Hawaii had an important role in our most recent edition of Coin World, as Paul Jokes reported on the fact that, you know, back before the COVID pandemic, there were always reveal events of certain coins and that type of thing. And in fact, on May 6th, actually May 5th and May 6th, the U.S. Mint traveled all the way over to Hawaii to unveil the latest quarter in the American Women's Quarter Series. Now, I'm going to tell you it's the Edith quarter, because I'm not even going to try to butcher her last name. But I thought that was kind of neat. That was another Hawaii-related story here. And, of course, our latest quarter going into circulation is in reference to a native Hawaiian. So I thought that your timing on this particular This Week in Numismatic History was very fortuitous. So congratulations on that.
So can you stop telling the story before it comes out? Because, yes, that is also one of the items that I highlight for the cover story of the July issue. That's Hawaiian numismatics. So.
I want to see more. I know there's more to it. It's one thing to get a tidbit, then you get a second tidbit. There's a whole lot more than that. But just like I say, that was in the news. It was a May 5th and 6th event.
Yes, it was. It was in the news. It's out there. This story will bring those elements and several more together. And so I won't reveal the rest of it. But what I will do is go back in time to 2019 for This Week in Coin World History. We went with 2019 because that was the year that Cameron McLean did his first blog post in relation to the Hunterian. He also received an award that year. So we went to the June 10th, 2019 issue, and it was on page 6, but I thought in hindsight it was interesting, especially, and now it aligns with your reference to the women quarters. What is the story? This was from our friend Chris Bullfinch. The story headlined, "Women's Suffrage Silver Dollar Sought." Second head or subhead is, "Legislation calls for commemorative silver dollar to mark 2020 centennial." This story is about legislation that was introduced in the 116th Congress that would, if enacted, create a 2020 commemorative silver dollar to honor the centennial of women's suffrage in the United States, which happened in 2020, of course, 100 years after the fact, 1920. This coin did come to fruition. This did coin come to pass. You can add this to your collection if you do not yet have it. It's the Women's Suffrage Centennial. The U.S. Mint sold proof NVU versions. There's a silver medal as well with the design. So It's one of the more recent commemorative coins in the U.S. If you haven't gotten it, it's not too late. You can find them in the aftermarket. But from a historical context, even just 4 years ago, it was interesting to see that, sometimes legislation is introduced and goes nowhere. In this case, the legislation was successful, and it led to something that many people have in their collections today.
And that's the nice thing about some of the more recent issues when we talk about them, because a lot of people remember the news that happened and was covered in that. And even some of the topics that are covered in the letters are of recent memory. One of the letters on the pages of the June 10th, 2019 issue says, "Once these designs used." The letter starts off, "Regarding new designs on American Eagle gold and silver bullion coins. Since the peace dollar, the designs on all our circulation coins have either been ordinary or traditional, since they reflect portraits of past presidents or statesmen, with the exception of the current golden dollar coin. Most of the modern series of commemorative coins are more illustrated than artistic when compared to the better ones struck from 1892 to 1954. If the current Mint director decides to follow the pattern begun in 1986, using two of the great designs of the past, I would recommend the Gobrek Seated Liberty No Stars obverse be placed on the Silver American Eagle and John Reich's cap bust design that first appeared on the obverse of the $5 half eagle be chosen for the four gold American Eagle denominations. Otherwise, stand pat." A letter from Arno Safran via email. So again, designs and thinking about designs and the artistic side of things seems to be a constant, whether you're looking at something 4 years ago or something 40 years ago.
Themes are important no matter how you slice it. I mean, the themes, the designs, that's all, I think, drives interest in the coins. We see that. We know that. I always say stories sell coins. So that's I think another truism out there. But I don't know if you agree with that. Am I on target with that?
I think you are. I mean, for the most part, I mean, it's variations. I mean, we all have our likes and dislikes. And I know you focus a lot on artistic type things. And, you know, me, for somebody who is just, most of the people don't even care. I mean, when I had somebody tell me a wheat ear scent was from Canada, I just pretty much figured that, you know, okay, you're not as concerned about coin designs and that type of thing. But I really think that, you know, it depends on the individual. So,
okay, well, I think you're right. Now I get to find out if you're right again in another context. Last episode, we were exploring the world of paper knot geld, but I went a different direction. I asked you about metal knot geld. Specifically, there is a famous German musician, or somebody related to the music field, the field of music, who is featured on Metallic, M-E-T-A-L-L-I-C, Metallic Knot Geld. Do you know who this person is and the issue or issues that feature this person?
Well, I think I know, because I utilized my time when I was looking around to add some items to my own collection or my wife's collection, and thought, while I'm here, I'm just going to try to scope around, see if I can find something. And lo and behold, I found one that was available on one of the online sales platforms. And I believe in this case, what I'm talking about is the 25 Pfennig from 1920 for Bonn with Beethoven on it. So that's what I have.
So you are correct to identify that Ludwig von Beethoven is the person to whom I refer. But in addition to that 25 Pfennig, there's also a 10 Pfennig and 50 Pfennig. In checking this today, saw that that piece was listed on the platform you reference. I don't mean to be cagey, yes, there is one out there. It's readily available, very affordable. The three denominations, Ludwig von Beethoven. So I'm giving it to you. You didn't get all three, but you got the guy, and you nailed it. The city of Bonn. So good for you.
Yeah, 3 out of 4 ain't bad. So
all right, Meatloaf.
Yeah, got it. The nomination, one of the denominations, but I got the rest of the details, and that's what's important to me.
So now it's time to put you and the listeners to the test again. You know, we're talking with Cameron, who's in Scotland. So I wanted to explore an area of modern Scottish numismatics, if you will. Scotland is part of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland and Scotland and Wales. The four constituents of the United Kingdom. And we talk about that in the episode. The round pound that the United Kingdom used from 1983 to 2016, there are several design motifs that relate to Scotland. They alternated design motifs to honor the various constituencies, right? There's four constituents. And so some of these designs changed every year. Just give me two of those design elements that honor Scotland. That's it. And there's technically there's four available from which to choose. Five, actually, come to think of it. So there's five different possibilities here. I think we'll say easy, but if you know your British pounds, if you've seen a good number of them, you might be able to get it. Maybe it's expert level. Yeah, I'll call it expert level, but I think you're up for the test. Give that some consideration. Think about that as you listen to our interview with Cameron McLean. The Coin World podcast is delighted today to be joined by Cameron McLean, who is a PhD candidate at the University of Glasgow. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you very much for having me.
So I have to, this is such a neat thing to get to talk to you. You're, 25% of the way around the world, and we're on the heels of the Northern Modern Early Network, I think that's what it is, Early Modern Network, Northern Early Modern Network handling session, just as we record this a few days ago, and you are at, you're volunteer at the Hunterian, which is has a fantastic coin collection, numismatic collection there in Scotland. What is a handling session, and can you explain that, and maybe we can hear about some of the goodies that you introduced other folks to that, they didn't even have a numismatic background. So this was brand new to them, maybe.
Recently the Northern Early Modern Network held its annual conference at the in Glasgow. And as part of that, I hosted a coin handling session using coins from the collection of the Hunterian Museum. Which contains one of the world's greatest numismatic collections. And I suppose I should say that the aim of the session was to look at the changes and developments that were made to minting technology during the early modern period. So I focused on a period starting in the 1560s during the reign of Elizabeth I in England, during which some of the earliest attempts to mechanize the English coinage were made. And I continued it all the way up until the early 1820s, when after centuries of development, British coins began to take on a form that's very similar to the ones that we're using today. And it was really incredibly special to get to use the Hunterian's collection to do this, because it's such an expansive collection that the chances are that if it's an English, a Scottish, or a British coin, there's a very good chance that the Hunterian has at least one. So being able to show, just some incredible coins, some of which are unique, to an audience of people who primarily hadn't handled historic coins before was very, very special.
So you mentioned Scottish, British, English, but before we get too much further into this, maybe for those folks who aren't aware of the connection and the way things interact or don't interact, Can you define or explain, Scottish coins have a unique, I guess, background until 1707 and the Act of Union, when yes. Scotland became part of what's now, you know, the United Kingdom. They had their own coinage and all that. What's, how did that work, and how should we think about that to keep the two straight?
Well, so from about 1136 up until 1707, Scotland had its own coinage, and its relationship to the English coinage really did differ depending on what period you look at. So initially, Scottish coins were based upon the English coins that were produced south of the border, and they were actually interchangeable. But over the centuries, they diverged from each other. But my PhD is examining something called the Anglo-Scottish Monetary Union, which was a period in which the Scottish and English coinages, after centuries of divergence, actually began to align again. And I can give you a little bit of context on that, if you would like.
Yeah.
Okay. So in 1603, King James VI of Scotland, he ascended to the throne of England on the death of Elizabeth I, who died without children. Now, this James's accession to the English throne began an era of legal union between Scotland and England, and this is known as the Union of the Crowns. And during this period, Scotland and England shared the same monarch, but the kingdoms or parliaments and their laws remained completely separate. And a year after this union, in 1604, King James established a monetary union between his kingdoms of Scotland and England. And basically, as part of this union, each kingdom was to produce coins of the same standard, weight and comparative value that could be used interchangeably in both kingdoms. But they also maintained their own separate currencies, that being the pound Scots in Scotland and the pound sterling in England, and their own separate mints. And my PhD is on this monetary union, and it's primarily concerned with how it was established and the extent to which it was maintained in the decades following its establishment.
So I guess the thing that I was surprised by, or what you mentioned, their own mints, but at some point the Tower Mint was involved in producing Scottish coins. And it, you know, for, I hate to admit this, for as long as I've been involved in this and as much as I've been able to learn over the years, it didn't connect, or I didn't remember, if anything else, that was how things went. I'll let you answer.
So historically, the Tower Mint in London never directly produced Scottish coins. But what did occur is they would sometimes supply dyes to the Scottish Mint.
Ah.
This primarily occurred in the late 17th century. But there is a case at the very outset of the monetary union where the English Mint did supply some dyes to the Scottish Mint, and that's something that I'm going to be discussing in the PhD. Although what did happen in 1707, and I think this is what you might have been referring to, is Scotland and England are politically unified into the Kingdom of Great Britain. And as part of this union, the pound Scots is abolished and the pound sterling is adopted in Scotland. And from that point on, with the exception of a few years immediately following the union, all British coins, which are then British due to the union rather than Scottish or English, are produced at the London Mint.
And I remember, I certainly knew that there was, like in the 20th century, there was English and Scottish designs on some of the coins that co-circulated, but...
Yes. So that's the shilling of King George VI and also Elizabeth II. Her pre-decimal shilling featured both an English and a Scottish design, but they would have circulated in both countries. I've heard that supposedly the reason they did that was to sort of pay homage to Queen Elizabeth, the Queen Mother, so that's the consort of George VI, who was born in Scotland, but I'm not 100% sure if that's true.
So let's go back to the handling session. Who were the folks that were brought in for this? There was a two-day conference, and what sort of numismatic delicacies, rarities, some of the best pieces in the collection that they got to, I guess, handle, hold? I mean, or were you holding it and they looking
at it? Oh, no, they got to... to handle the coins. It was completely interactive. So as I said previously, the main aim was to showcase the developments in minting technology during the early modern period, but I also wanted to give them a good overview of just the history of coin production in general. So the earliest coin that we got to handle was a half stater produced by the Kingdom of Lydia in the 6th century BC. Mm. But I also wanted to, before I got into the developments of the 16th century, I wanted to let them see a range of just some of the coins that were produced using the hammered method, over the course of about 2,000 years. So just to give you an idea of some of the coins we looked at, one of them was the... And I should preface this by saying because this was, for most of them, the first time handling historic coins, I wanted to make it special and, you know, show coins that really would draw people in due to their incredible designs and the amazing stories behind them. So one of the coins that we looked at was the Ides of March denarius of Brutus, which is, it's probably one of the most famous coins. And it was struck by Brutus to celebrate the assassination of Julius Caesar on the Ides of March, and I think it was 44 BC, but I was always terrible at classics, so who knows. And another one was a coin of the Eastern Roman Emperor Marcian, and it was struck in 450 AD to celebrate his marriage to Pulcheria. And what's significant about it is that it's actually the earliest coin to depict Jesus Christ. He appears on the reverse between the imperial couple, and it's the only coin of its type in existence. So it's an incredibly special coin. And looking at the Scottish side of things, another of the coins that people were handling was the gold noble of David II, which is the earliest Scottish gold coin to be struck, and it was one of just four in existence. So I really wanted to show some special pieces.
Some really cool stuff. Really cool stuff.
Do you think that those who were taking part in the handling session got an appreciation of the message you're trying to give, not just about the mintages, but just about the idea of the historic significance of these elements?
The feedback that I got was great. People seem to really enjoy it, and I'm hoping to do it again in the future. It really is. It's one thing to, show a PowerPoint, demonstration, but to actually, let people see the coins in person and handle them as you're discussing them. I mean, it really is, it's hands-on history. And, even throughout my time at university, the classes that I've always remembered have been the hands-on one, whether that's looking at, medieval weapons or medieval manuscripts. That's what always, that was always the most memorable aspect of university for me. So I was kind of hoping to replicate that in this session, by giving people a sort of hands-on.
The hands-on experience.
Giving them a hands-on experience.
I mean, it's one thing to utilize the sense of sight to see these elements, but then to utilize the touch and get the actual feel for the dimensional side of things here. But, I'm more stuck on the history side of things, and kind of curious about you, Cameron. How did you get involved? How did you get interested in history that's taken you on this path to where you are today?
I suppose I've always been fascinated by coins. I started collecting them when I was about 12, completely due to chance. So there was a market in Glasgow called the Barras, and when I was about 12 years old, my dad took me there, and we came across somebody that was selling Roman coins. And, I got a few of them, and that's pretty much where it started. I've been collecting them ever since. And then once I went to university, my focus was always on coinage, mainly Scottish. But it's just something that I've continued since that point.
And you've been very active in your time in university, receiving numerous awards, working on exhibitions and other things. That must be a treat to be able to sort of play. I use the word play with all reverence in this sense, to have at your disposal a world-class collection with which to play every day.
To be honest, it's been the highlight of my time at Glasgow University, and I'm very fortunate in that I get to catalogue portions of the Hunterian. And so I'm in usually once a week. And to be honest, it's the highlight of my week. And it has been ever since I started a good few years ago. It really is. It's a real privilege to get to handle, you know, coins of that caliber and get to catalogue them and contribute towards, I suppose, making them accessible to the public through cataloguing.
So let's explain maybe the Hunterian collection. How was it created? How did all these great rarities end up there in Glasgow?
So mostly by chance, I suppose. So the Hunterian is named after Dr. William Hunter, who was an 18th century physician. He founded an anatomy school in London, and he also served as Queen Charlotte's personal physician. So that's the consort of George III. And he was incredibly successful, and he used the proceeds of this to assemble a ginormous collection, not just of coins, but of medieval manuscripts, other antiques, insects, and medical specimens. I mean, if you can think of it, he probably collected it. But as part of this, from about 1770 to 1783, he assembled a collection of about 30,000 coins. And it was actually said at the time of his death that this coin collection was second only to that of King Louis XVI of France's, which is quite incredible that the only person that could match him was a literal king. But no, Hunter was a fascinating figure. He was incredibly well connected. George III himself contributed a coin to his collection, and he also knew Benjamin Franklin. So the collection itself is astonishing. Its largest components are mainly Greek and Roman, but he also assembled quite a large collection of Scottish, English, and British coins. But yeah, these were, upon his death in 1783, these were donated to the University of Glasgow, and they formed the foundation of what became the Hunterian Museum. And, you know, over the centuries, this initial coin collection of 30,000 pieces has expanded through subsequent donations to a collection of about maybe 100,000 pieces in total. And the quality of it really is incredible. I mean, especially looking at the Hunter portion, most of the coins look like they were struck yesterday.
So
that's amazing to me, because we're talking about a timeline here where we in the States start talking about coinage right around 1800. Here's a collection that was amassed decades before that and has grown substantially over time.
Yeah, it really is incredible. And there's a relatively small portion of Hunter's original collection that I think would be is of American interest, in that he assembled a I mean, it's a small, but it's a significant collection of coins of the Massachusetts Bay Colony. So, you know, I think it's the coins with the trees on them, and they're all dated. I think it's 1652, but they were struck in the decades after that. And what's amazing about them is, given the time frame in which he was collecting, so that's 1770 to 1783, it's actually possible that he could have acquired at least a few of these coins while the American War of Independence was ongoing. And in fact, they're actually what's incredible about this small parcel of coins is that they actually have the earliest known provenance of any 17th century American coins. So yeah, they're very, very special.
That's incredible. That's really, really cool from, you know, an American standpoint. Now, I have to ask, and this is not a gotcha, we're not about that, but how does the Hunterian collection of Scottish coins compare to Lord Stewart be? I know that's a sort of the modern era, you know, the dominant, the most well-known and largest collection in the modern era. How do they compare, and is there any relationship there? Did Lord Stewart be used the Hunterian as a resource as he built his collection? Do you know?
Yes. So I never met Lord Stewartby, but he did put together the largest collection of Scottish coins ever assembled by a private individual. It numbers about 6,000 pieces, and it's currently in the process of being published into Seligies. The first one's been released, and I think there's two more coming. So the Lord Stewartby collection is actually held in the Hunterian, and it numbers about 6,000 pieces. It's the single largest collection of Scottish coins ever assembled by a private individual, and its range is just incredible. In fact, it's amazing to think about it, but it actually accounts for about 25% of all Scottish coins in existence. But compared to Hunter's Scottish collection, the quality of Hunter's coins are incredible, but they are it's a relatively small collection. It's only a few hundred pieces, but it does include some great rarities, including the David II Noble that I mentioned earlier. So that's Scotland's first gold coin.
And can you talk about the piece that you teased this or showed this on social media that could have been owned by the king? There's only three pieces known. That was a fun, that's a fun piece.
Oh, yes, it is. Now, I didn't include this in the handling session, but what it is in 1633, King Charles I, who was King of Scotland and England, he had a separate Scottish coronation. So he travelled up to Scotland, and as part of these celebrations, medals were struck. Now, these were struck both in silver and gold, but one of the specimens held by the Hunterian is very special because it contains an edge inscription. And this edge inscription, I think it records the maker, so that's Nicholas Briel. And it also records that it was struck in Edinburgh from Scottish gold. But what's most remarkable about it is that only three of these particular medals with the edge inscription were struck in gold. And we know from an inventory of the royal collection that that Charles I himself actually owned one of them. So there's a one-third chance that that medal in the collection could very well have belonged to Charles I. So when you hold it, you know, there is that real connection with history. It's just amazing to think of who, even if the king himself didn't handle it, just it was obviously a very high status gift, so it would have been someone who was close to him that would have owned it. So, you know, it's an amazing connection with history.
So I have to ask, we've talked about the scope of the Hunter collection. It seems like because of the, and this is your area of focus, this straddles the line between the hand-hammered coinage and the milled coinage, the mechanized production. And there's an interesting character from that era who was involved. Can you talk about how the collection straddles that line and then tell the story of Aloy Mistral?
Oh yeah, of course. So the collection contains numerous Scottish and English coins from the 16th and 17th century, and that's the period where we see the transition from hammered coinage to mechanized coinage. So in Scotland's last hammered coins were struck in 1636, and England's last hammered coins were struck in 1662. But more so, not so much in Scotland, but in England, it really is. It's a long process to get to the point where the mechanized method takes over completely from the hammered method. But one of the earliest pioneers in England, or the earliest pioneer, I should say, was a Frenchman named Aloy Mistral. And he came to England early in the reign of Elizabeth I. And I believe in 1561, he began to produce coins at the English Mint using a very small screw press. And, you know, many of these coins are preserved in the collection. So it was great to let people hold a few examples of Mistral's pieces, because when you compare them to the hammered coins, the difference in quality is really apparent. And even at the time, contemporaries did notice the superior quality of Mistral's pieces. So they would often keep them as pocket pieces, or they would sometimes be used as gaming counters. And in fact, they're even mentioned in one of Shakespeare's plays. But Mistral was an interesting figure because he faced a lot of opposition at the English Mint and quite a few setbacks. And one of the worst of these, in fact, the worst of these setbacks, was that in 1568, one of his kinsmen, a man named Philip, was actually arrested and then later convicted for counterfeiting coin, which at that time was treason, and he was executed. Now, Eloy himself was implicated in this, but his involvement seemed to have been quite minimal. So he was granted a royal pardon. But as you can imagine, when he eventually returned to the mint and began to produce coins again, he was treated with a lot of suspicion. So he was denied access to many of his tools. So if you look at the coins that he produced from about 1570 onwards, when he regained access to the mint, the quality really does take a hit. I mean, just comparing his early sixpences to his later ones, you can see the bust is a lot more crude. The lettering is incredibly crude as well. In fact, the ends that he uses are backwards. And Mistrel was so desperate that what he did is, or at least it's been interpreted, that he produced a medal. It's called the Defence of the Realm or the Defence of the Kingdom medal. But it's quite similar to sixpences. So it depicts Elizabeth I on the obverse, but the reverse depicts the Tower of London, which is where the mint was then located. And the legend on the reverse translates to "What is this without tools?" And this has been interpreted as a plea to Elizabeth I for the return of Mistrel's tools, but this wasn't forthcoming, and his fortunes didn't improve. So what happened was, in 1572, Mistrel's method was subject to a trial to assess its efficiency, and it was found to be much less efficient than the hammered method. So he lost his position at the mint, and the striking of milled coins came to an end. And that was, it wouldn't be until the early 1600s that circulating coins would again be produced by machine in England. And just as a postscript to that, in 1577, Mistrel was actually arrested for counterfeiting coin and then executed in the following year after his conviction.
Looking at the annals of history to hear about Mistrel, and his son was executed for counterfeiting. There is quite a rapscallion, quite a character in the history, both numismatically and otherwise. So
yep.
There's so much more we could learn about and talk about with this, but I want to leave, I want to let you have the last word about the collection, about seeing the collection. How can folks, if you can't get to Glasgow, I wish I had been able to get there. I've not been able to get to see the collection. You're putting a lot of stuff on social media. Should we follow you? Is there stuff at the Hunterian website, or do you guys do any sort of like e-learning or video classes or anything? I love to learn more about this topic. Maybe our listeners do as well. How would they partake and delve into what the collection has to offer?
Well, there's several ways. So the Hunterian itself has a searcher collections function, and many of the coins in the collection, although not all of them, have been placed on that. So you can search for coins there, and usually there'll be an image, but sometimes there isn't. There's also a few online exhibits you can look at, which are usually connected to exhibits that have taken place in person. So one of my favorites is, a few years ago, they created a very useful webpage that covers coinage of the Crusader states. And it's a really, really great introduction to the topic if anyone's interested. But if you do happen to be in Glasgow, or sorry, I should say, if you want, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at cmclean96. I do put objects from the Hunterian up there from time to time. But if you are in Glasgow, you can visit the main gallery of the Hunterian itself. Usually there aren't too many coins on display, but every now and then temporary exhibits devoted to coins do occur. So in the past, we've had exhibits on Scottish coins. There was one a few years ago on Byzantine coins. But one that's coming up in just in a few days, actually, is there will be an exhibit on Jacobite medals called Chasing the Jacobite Dream, and that opens on the 2nd of June. So that's definitely worth a visit if you're in the Glasgow area.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for all of the information. There's lots of stuff you've written, blog posts out there. Anybody can search for that and find
yes.
as well. Yeah. There's lots of good information. You've given us a lot today as well. Boy, I wish I could have been there for the handling session, but such is life. In any event, we got to speak to you today and learn a lot, and I think the listeners will learn a lot as well. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me. Just before I go, I'd like to thank Dan Marion of the Missouri Numismatic Society for putting us in contact and suggesting that I come on this podcast, because I wouldn't even have considered it as a possibility without that. So thank you to him.
Absolutely. Dan is a hard-working guy. He's sort of the guy who is heading the show committee and doing all sorts of stuff. He's a consummate collector, nice guy, and yep. I appreciate him pointing us your direction. So we'll let that maybe stand as the last word. Thank you.
Sorry, one last thing. Thank you. I'm really sorry. And also I'd like to thank Jesper Eriksson, who's the curator of the Hunterian Numismatic Collection, because he's the one that's provided access for my research and for the handling session. So thank you to him.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. No, the anybody who's involved in that, helping you get access to that, we appreciate it, because you're doing some fun stuff, some great work, and we thank you again. And that was our interview with Cameron McLean. We want to thank him for taking time out to... Man, it was just on the heels of a big event for him, so... And as you noted earlier, this took some arranging to get together. So we're thankful that it all came together finally, and we got to share that with everyone out there in podcast land.
Indeed. I mean, it's always a great way when you sit there and, I mean, learning a lot. I mean, this is the primary purpose is information and education. And a lot of times we bring on people who are directly affected by this. I mean, I haven't had the opportunity, but certainly want to learn more about the Hunterian collection. And it's just the idea that that's what we do. We plant seeds here. I mean, it's just like, we want to make sure we've got a lot of great guests in store. A lot of folks that have said, hey, when my schedule calms down, kind of like what Cameron had to go through, when my schedule calms down, I want to get there. So, you know, we just appreciate the fact that these individuals are willing to share the knowledge that they've gained with all of our listeners here. And we appreciate that. I mean, that's just not something to take lightly.
Absolutely not. So, we're kind of a shorter episode. We wanted to allow time for our discussion with Cameron, but we're hopefully we covered all the stuff you're used to and expect. We certainly have fun doing it. I will say you mentioned picking up a brochure. I think you were referring to the Higgins Museum in Okoboji. I think that's how you say it.
Bingo.
I would love to go there. Never been there. And it's within a day's drive anyway.
Yeah. I want to get us back to the days that we start doing these numismatic journeys, because I want to go out and see that bar that has all those silver dollars in it. I mean, that's something on my list. And you just never know. I mean, I'll bypass the world's, you know, biggest ball of string, or the biggest friend of mine just went to the biggest arch made of elk horns and that type of thing. I mean, that's great, but you know, that's not my numismatic bent here. So, you know, I want to seek that stuff out. I mean, I want to go places where, you know, where the designers are buried. I think there's a place up in Owosso, Michigan, is just some of the things that, you know, would like to do. And museum pieces. I want to someday see the go to the Smithsonian and see the what's going on there with the really big money. So on my bucket list, gonna be happening.
Yes, it's good to have goals and dreams like that. So we need to get going so we can compare notes and figure out how we can make all this happen.
No, we need to get going so we can get going. That's what it comes down to.
Yes, so we can get going to these places. So, hey, thanks again, everybody out there. If you have any questions, complaints, good thoughts for us, we do appreciate hearing from you. Let us know what you're adding to your collection or what direction you're going. You can find all that online connect with Larry or I, and we're going to keep keep plugging away and got a few more things lined up and working on some other things. But, you know, as always, until next time,
happy collecting.
Thank you for listening to the Coin World Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe and we'll see you next week.
Coin World Plus is your new way to collect, manage your inventory, digitally authenticate coins, create your want list, buy and sell coins, and much more. Learn more about Coin World Plus at coinworldplus.com or download the app now at Google Play or the App Store.